Okay, take two. Hey, folks, I'm Mike Lafferty, your host of the BAMF podcast, and we're here today doing another comic roundtable. And let's just do a quick roll call, starting with Steve.
Hi, I'm Steve Kenson.
Mm-hmm. And glad to have you, Steve. And Chris, you're next.
I'm Professor Christopher McLaughlin.
Mm-hmm.
Hi.
Is that your theme music in the background?
Apparently so.
Next up, we got Walter Billiard.
Good evening, everybody.
Yeah. And last but not least, Mr. Aid Smith, our member from the UK.
Hello there.
Hey. So, we're going to talk about cosmic supers, because they're kind of a big deal these days. And, heck, there's going to be a Guardians of the Galaxy movie, for Christ's sakes, and that's hard to believe. Mm. But we're going to throw it out there. What's everyone's favorite and or least favorite cosmic comic run? And, Chris, I think we were giving you this question first.
Yeah, well, I have to do it without the gasps this time. But yes, it has not changed in the last 5 minutes. It is still the Keith Giffen and Tom and Mary Bierbaum run on the Legion of Superheroes in the early 90s.
Well, sweet. Explain why.
Well, comic book stories, if they take chances, they hit a certain point where you cross what I like to call the Elseworlds line. You know that none of this will ever be referred to again, or it'll all get reset in 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
Like let's say, let's just pick a random event, like Robin getting killed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or any given X-Man being killed. You know, nobody believes that's going to last anymore. But Tom and the Bierbaum and Giffen run on Legion was the one time where major chances were taken with characters with the thought that there would be no going back, that this would be the status quo. And during the roughly 5 years that they were on that title, it was the real status quo of the Legion. Characters were reinvented, characters died, characters changed sex. You know, I don't think I've ever had a run of comics where that many chances were taken and lasted. And I just think, and it's so well written, and you know the fact that, and that it's just constantly hitting you with plot twists, and you know that nobody's going to. Well, you have the expectation that nobody's going to hit the reset button as much as you ever have that with DC Comics. You know, every 10 years they're going to hit the reset button, but this one, you know, it was good. It kept you going. You weren't looking for the reboot, even though it eventually came. So yeah, I just think it's a masterful work in comics, very underrated.
Oh, cool. Steve, that's a favorite of yours too, right?
I am very fond of the Giffen and Bierbaum period of the Legion. I'm a big Legion fan in general, so you know, all of the various incarnations of the Legion, I've been through them with every numerous reboot, and you know, each version has had its own, you know, sort of charms to it. So
all right, well, I've never really been able to get into the Legion, although I tried during Mark Waid's kind of short run.
Mm-hmm.
Can you kind of, you know, sum up for me briefly, what's the what's the DNA of the appeal of the Legion? What really does it for you?
I guess that I was always fond of the Legion for the sheer breadth of both the setting and the team. You know, the Legion very quickly went from being this, you know, trio of kids from the future and, you know, became this sort of cast of thousands very early on, and maintained that, you know, throughout most of its history. So the Legion was always this big sort of sprawling hero team that was appropriately enough, you know, responsible for defending this big sprawling, you know, intergalactic interstellar civilization. So I just kind of liked, the comic geek in me, you know, liked the fact that there were so many Legionnaires, and that they were all, you know, fairly distinctive. So you were playing a lot of just memorizing who was who and keeping track of it all. I could see how that would be less appealing to a comics, you know, newbie who was trying to get into the book and going, who are all of these people? But when I was a young kid reading comics, you know, I was pretty fond of the idea.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I've always kind of had the same roadblock as them as I had with the X-Men. You know, I have friends who are in the X-Men. I understand there's cool stuff that's happening there, but it's, you know,
there's too damn many of them.
Yeah, and the backstory is a little baroque.
Hmm.
So I just never really got into them either. But all right, cool. Aid, how about you?
That's pretty tough. Probably. I remember the Ron Lim Silver Surfer stuff, which is really, really good. Most commonly, Annihilation books, I think, is something I bought in hardcover when they came out, because after reading the first issue of everything, I completely skipped them, but it was running parallel with another event at the time, so that was definitely worth buying. But, I mean, Guardians of the Galaxy I've bought pretty much anything they put out, even including the old 31st Century Guardians of the Galaxy versions as well, with Charlie 27 and all those characters as well. But yeah, I think it's weird. I always loved Captain Marvel, the Marvel version, of course. And Miss Marvel, when she was Cosmic, that was all pretty good as well. So, I mean, there's plenty of stuff in there, but I've never really had a definitive run of anything. I think the only thing that I can think of off the top of my head is the old Guardians books. And then they've obviously gone into the new Guardians books with Groot and Rocket Raccoon, and that character's just marvellous. Rocket Raccoon's fantastic. But yeah, I mean, the current Garden series looks okay, but I'm not too sure what they're doing with it, because they put Iron Man in it yet again, which is very annoying. So to have an Avenger in every single title possibly going is getting a bit crazy at the moment. So
It's all about the movie crossovers.
Well, this is it, exactly. It's crazy. It's, I mean, where they should, of course, call themselves Avengers Comics Monthly rather than Marvel Comics, is just getting a bit mad. Or even subtitling Captain America and Iron Man as Avengers Captain America and Avengers Iron Man, sort of thing. We'll see. So, but yeah, cosmic stuff. Of course, one of my favourite characters is Thanos. Anything Thanos is in, I'll pretty much buy it, apart from, ironically enough, the series that just came out. So, because I'm not really interested in his kind of whiny childhood, really, than anything else. So.
I thought that was an odd choice. I mean, who really wants to know what Thanos was like as a little type?
Exactly. I just thought of one that was fantastic. First time I read Infinity Gauntlet, that was fantastic. That was amazingly well paced. I remember being absolutely well happy with that. Yeah, yeah.
Well, cool. Now, you've read the new Nova, haven't you?
I have.
What do you think about that?
All in all, pretty good. It was a book I considered picking up anyway, because I had Ed McGuinness doing the artwork, which pretty much sells me on anything he draws. Complete reboot yet again. Basically, the new Nova apparently is supposedly the son of an old Nova that kind of was a Nova 25 years or 27 years in the past. So we're kind of predating Richard Rider and, well, technically predating Richard Rider, not really. But basically, his dad's kind of become like this alcoholic drunk guy, and this little kid has basically discovered that he's, you know, he may be the next Nova by Gamora and Rocket Raccoon turning up on his doorstep. All in all, it's a pretty cool book. I probably will end up buying the trade paperback of it. When it actually collects, because I think McGuinness is only on the first five or six issues, so once that's collected, we'll see where he picks up after that. The annoying thing, to be honest, is they introduce some really cool, like, Nova Corps characters, but if you go in, they're from like 27 years ago, so if you go in the timeline for anything that happened in Annihilation, technically speaking, they should be all dead or missing from the Corps. So you've kind of introduced all these really cool characters. Oh, they weren't going to show. Oh, actually, they should be all dead by now. So that's kind of annoying.
Well, hey, you know, what we're talking about, and I'm a big Nova Corps fan, but they're very similar to the Green Lantern Corps. I was never really clear how they bring back all those Green Lanterns, like Kilowog, who had been killed at least three or four times. And one day he just kind of shows up on Earth when Geoff Johns wanted him to. Was there any kind of logic to that?
Kilowog came back in a Joe Casey hardcover that, like everything else Joe Casey has ever written, is shoved back into the mercy corner of my brain, far, far, far away from anything that I ever need to call up.
Yeah.
And the rest of them that get killed during Emerald Twilight just sort of wandered back into frame. And if it was ever brought up, but wait, weren't you dead? I didn't take.
Yeah. Yeah, that was kind of largely glossed over in the sort of return of Hal Jordan, and the whole bringing back the Green Lantern Corps was a lot of it was just like, oh yeah, most of them not that dead. It turns out.
Okay, that's what I thought. I like most of Geoff Johns' run, but I kind of gave up when they had like five different cores with different colors, because it just
that's when it got good.
Actually, that's when it got pretty good.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
Then I
the whole War of Light thing.
Dark Knight stuff. Sorry, Steve.
No, I was just saying the whole War of Light thing is actually pretty cool.
Okay, maybe I was wrong then, because I kind of looked at it and said, ah, Skittles in space, I'm done here. But
it was awesome. Yeah. It was awesome enough to do the ultimate in a Hal Jordan story to distract you from how really boring and bland Hal Jordan is.
Right.
Okay, so which one's the best Lantern then, if Hal Jordan's the boring man?
Kyle. Alan Scott.
Wow.
I knew that was going to be something like that.
Yeah.
Well, Hal's a close second.
That's going to stick in the work.
See, I've always been a Guy Gardner fan. To be honest,
there you go.
Guy Gardner is always one of my favorites.
I really liked how they did Guy Gardner in the Green Lantern animated series.
Did you hear why they canceled that?
Apparently, the series. Well, as I understand it, and this is, you know, I read the same news as everybody else, but you know, as I understand it, a lot of it had to do with the fact that the movie tanked so badly.
Yeah, there was a lot of movie merchandise hanging out.
Yeah.
And they couldn't really sell enough cartoon merchandise because everyone was, yeah. So.
Right, right.
That's a bummer.
Okay, yeah. I've changed my mind. My favorite actually Green Lantern is Nor.
Oh.
So, that's the one I'm sticking with now, okay?
Yeah. You and my wife.
Hey, Walt, so what's your favorite cosmic run?
Oh, God, I'm going to be dating myself and embarrassing myself all in the same time. Rom the Space Knight.
Oh, shit, nice.
You know, and the reason I say that is because, you know, I grew up reading comics pretty much probably around the same time as everybody else in the panel. And, yeah. You know, so much, you know, when he started getting into, like, all the X-Men started becoming popular, and pretty soon that was all anybody wanted to talk about or what have you. And, you know, but then there were these other cool books that were out there that nobody was really kind of keying on, but, you know, mm-hmm. just every week they were just turning in some really interesting stuff, like, you know, here's this guy that gives up his entire existence to save his, you know, turn himself into something less than the rest of the people he's saving and become more at the same time to mm-hmm. help, you know, to rescue that which is most precious to him, which yeah. I thought was really neat. And then at the same time, you know, everybody's fighting these guys in tights with superpowers and stuff, and this guy's fighting basically demons in space with a yeah. giant flashlight. I had to run out and get that toy immediately.
I am totally with Walt. I mean, Rom was some really classic, overwrought Marvel melodrama. You know, any character who has as many, you know, just heart-wrenching soliloquies as Rom does, because he's constantly talking to himself in the book about how tortured his existence is just pure comics gold. I mean, you know.
Speaking of tortured, Rom almost made a comeback.
Yes, almost. Very nearly.
When they released the preview art for Age of Ultron, there was a big dartboard with all these cosmic characters on there, and Rom is in the middle of it.
The great irony of it is that because of the nature of the relationship with, I think it's Mattel,
mm-hmm.
Is that because Bill Mantlo basically invented, because, you know, Rom was just this toy, you know, that had no backstory, no nothing to it. And so because Bill Mantlo basically invented basically everything about the Rom mythos, the only thing that Marvel can't use in the comics is Rom's actual name and image, which is why they're constantly referring to him as the greatest of space knights or you know, that sort of thing, all these euphemisms. But, you know, the space knights, the dire wraiths, Galador, the Black Nebula, the whole schmear, the whole history of it is all Marvel's except for Rom. So they've had a couple of very near misses, up to and including having a Space Knight character in Guardians of the Galaxy for a while.
Yeah, female one, wasn't it? Yeah.
That was in
Allied. His wife, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
His wife.
I thought you were talking about. Oh, you were talking about the. Oh, sorry. I was talking about the Annihilators that had Icon in it.
Yes. That's. Yeah, the Annihilators have Space Knight.
That's
yes.
it, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And while we're at it, let's take a second and say some love and prayers to Bill Mantlo.
Indeed.
Who's in a bad way, and is also responsible for my second favorite comic cosmic series of all time, the Micronauts.
Micronauts, yes.
Holy shit, I'd forgotten about them, and they're also tied up. that's another IP that's kind of, you know, divided.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. Well, that's a shame. Well, cool, cool. Hey, I forgot to mention this earlier in the podcast, and we should probably do it now before I forget again. Steve, can you give us an update on Great Power?
Yeah, basically, right now, Dan Solis is finishing up with the layout for Great Power. There were some delays on the art side of things, and particularly just some technical issues getting the art from Dan Hauser to Daniel for the layout. But those look like they're getting taken care of, and the layout is proceeding ahead. It's pretty much 90% done at this point, so it's really just a matter of getting things finished up. So I'm hoping that it'll be wrapped up pretty soon. It's one of those things that's sort of a, for me anyway, kind of a hurry up and wait kind of thing, because once the, you know, final files hit my inbox, there's this flurry of things that need to happen about getting surveys out to backers and, you know, getting things rolling in order to, you know, get things to production and get things available to folks. So it'll start moving really quickly once that happens. So I hope it'll be pretty soon. But for me, you know, it's the wait is in many ways just as long on my end as it is for anybody.
Yeah, I really hope you wait a little longer, because I would love to get Stark City out before, but I don't know if that's going to happen or not. But Abe,
the first book may well happen.
Okay,
if you look on the horizon, it's just peeking slightly over. Yeah, it's mm-hmm. waving at you. So yeah, there's a chance.
Okay, that's the advantage of releasing in chapters, is, you know, you can do some.
Exactly.
All right, cool. So that's the update on Stark City. We also had some art-related delays, but we brought in a staff of pinch hitters to care of things admirably. So we're really, I mean, everything's written, most of the art's done, and we're heading into final proofing pass with Mr. Chris Hurd doing the editing. And so everything's looking good. And so that's the update on the Kickstarters. And let me see. Hey, Walt. Okay, you talked about Run the Space Knights. Everyone talked about their most favorite cosmic runs. Anyone have a least favorite cosmic run they want to slag on while we're talking about it? We're all being positive tonight. I'm looking at you, Chris.
Okay, two real quick. Hated Jim Starlin's run on Adam Warlock, but nothing for me will inspire the absolute volcanic hatred that I have for Jack Kirby's Fourth World.
Really?
Hate.
You don't like the New Gods?
No, I don't like
travesty.
Well, okay. The new gods prove two things. There may never have been a better artist ever working the medium than Jack Kirby.
Mm-hmm.
There is not a clunkier writer that has ever worked in the medium than Jack Kirby. Because everything in the New Gods, I feel Jack Kirby's elbow hitting me in the ribs. Supertown. They're from Supertown. Get it? Get it? They're from Apocalypse. Get it? Get it? His name's Dissad. You laughing, son? You laughing? And here's the thing. Here's the amazing thing. The people that have taken over the property after Kirby are even worse. Has there ever been a greater waste of ink, paper, time, and talent than the Genesis crossover that DC did about 15 years ago?
Hmm.
I mean, John Byrne is not an untalented guy, and even he, with the entire DC line in his feet, uses the Fourth World to generate a giant. And that's probably being kind to it. So no.
Story's not good. What about characters? You can't say you don't like Darkseid.
Darkseid is around for one reason only. He's one of the few characters that DC has that can actually challenge Superman.
Exactly.
If Superman had a decent rogues gallery other than Lex Luthor, Darkseid would be another forgotten 70s concept. They'd be like the Green Team.
He does have Toy Man, as Aid points out.
Yeah.
Well, there's,
you know,
that's
get
true.
A toy, sir.
But he's there. Okay, Toy Man is a threat to Jimmy Olsen. He's not a threat to Superman. There's a difference.
Yeah. Okay. You know, the fourth world is something I always kind of thought I was missing out. The fact that you don't like it either. I mean, because Darkseid's an interesting villain, I'll give you that. But it just seems like DC keeps going back to that well so often and so hard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like if you're been to a restaurant, let's say Macaroni Grill, and they just love pepper, like it's the, you know, the only spice that exists. You know, it's they just keep hitting that, and I'm like, you know, I understand there's some cool concepts here, but you know, you got to keep hitting it so hard. So I don't know, just my take on that.
Mr. Miracle, Mr. Miracle is a cool character. I'm massively looking forward to him coming back in Earth 2.
Yes.
Yeah, Scott Free, that's classic.
You get it? You get it?
Okay, all right. Well, hey, speaking of cosmic super stuff, let's talk about Steve and Chris, who've recently written the Freedom City, Freedom Universe cosmic book.
Yes, there's the Cosmic Handbook, which kind of does double duty in the sense that it's both a genre book that talks a lot about the cosmic genre, the cosmic aspects of superheroes, and also has a fairly decent sized chapter that looks at the cosmos beyond Freedom City's Earth to get a greater sense of what that's like.
Okay, cool. Just out of curiosity, what kind of tips do you, what kind of advice do you give to GMs about dealing, you know, transferring from an Earth-based campaign to a cosmic one?
Well, you know, a lot of it is primarily a matter of scale. The big thing, no pun intended, about cosmic stuff is that everything is big. It's all, you know, city-sized ships and you know, planets blowing up and, you know, that's not a moon, that's a space station, you know, kind of scale of things. So a lot of it is really the idea of emphasizing the grandeur of it all, of, you know, it's all big stuff, of, you know, giant, you know, like the thing from War of Kings that led into a lot of the other Marvel cosmic stuff of, you know, there's a great tear in the fabric of the universe that's the size of a galaxy, and things like that, you know, just, you know, massively huge. So a lot of it is really just sort of advising the game master to run with that and to exercise, you know, a degree of, you know, flexibility in terms of just ignoring a lot of earthbound limits. You know, if you're dealing with cosmic characters who are supposed to be out flying around in space, dogfighting with spaceships, don't worry too much about what the exact range of their powers are, because, you know, you're dealing with huge distances. You know, just assume if they've got a ranged power that they can hit anything they can see. You know, those kinds of things. So a lot of it is just, you know, advising the game master to loosen up on some of the, you know, the earthbound limits, and to keep in mind that you're going to have to supply the characters with, you know, something that allows them to overcome the big primary challenges of being, you know, out beyond the bounds of Earth, which is namely, you know, life support and transportation.
Oh, cool. Hey, Walt, you had a question?
Yeah, this is pretty much for everybody. Now, you know, you see, like, movies where, you know, we've all had the experience of, well, some of us have had the experience of sitting in a movie theater and seeing that Star Destroyer come into view for the first time, and just the scope of it, you know, mm-hmm. even juxtaposed against that planet, you know. How do you bring that sense of scale, of, like, that wow factor that a lot of these cosmic games portray? How do you bring that to the game table?
Well, I think it's largely a matter of painting a picture. You know, I mean, unfortunately, you don't have a huge visual effects budget, you know, for a tabletop RPG. But you can certainly, you know, provide an evocative description and talk about how, you know, vast and ponderous, you know, something like a Star Destroyer is, and how, you know, it just rolls past, going on and on, you know, so that the players get a sense of that kind of size and that kind of grandeur. And to a certain degree, you cheat and you rely on the fact that we all have seen a lot of common, you know, movies like Star Wars, like, you know, any, you know, cosmic film that has, you know, that kind of, you know, vast scale, so that we can fall back on that and say, you know, it's kind of like that, and give players a sense of what that's like.
Now, in the upcoming source book, do you guys have rules and suggestions for taking things the other way? Like, instead of going Star Wars, do you have stuff that would be like, you know, like Battle of the Planets or, you know, things like that?
In what way?
So instead of very serious Guardians of the Galaxy, you know, out to save the universe, do you have things that are slightly more goofy?
Not a lot, you know, because, you know, my opinion is that most game groups don't need our help with that regard. you know, games have a tendency to finding goofy is usually not a problem. There's not a great deal of talk about that per se. You know, I could see how you could certainly come up with something like that pretty easily, but yeah, not a lot.
Okay, what kind of power level characters you're talking about? Are you talking like 15, 16, like the DC characters?
Well, that's
are we going to the 20s?
Well, that's one of the things the book talks about is starting off with defining what cosmic actually means, because in the comics it actually typically means one of two things that often have a tendency to overlap. One is cosmic, meaning like the cosmos, anything that takes place away from Earth, stuff that takes place mostly in outer space or on alien planets, things like that. You know, so cosmic characters, you know, fly through space, those sorts of things. And cosmic has also, you know, tended to mean in the comics characters that are tremendously powerful. But that isn't always the case. For example, you know, we said that the, you know, Legion of Superheroes could be considered a cosmic book. And while there certainly are some very powerful Legionnaires, the Legion as a group, probably not that far off from, you know, power level 10, most of them. Maybe the more experienced Legionnaires edge up a level or two. Yeah, while there certainly are, you know, higher power levels in the cosmic genre, and the book does definitely talk about that, of what it is you do with, you know, characters who are edging up, you know, into the, like, power level 15 or so range. It's not specifically it's not a requirement in order to run a cosmic game. You could run a cosmic game with a group of power level 8 characters if you wanted to, if they're tooling around space on a spaceship. You might be a little closer to Walt's, you know, kind of goofy game, you know, than anything else, but it could still happen.
I don't know, Space Ghost is probably power level 9.
Yeah, give or take.
Space Ghost.
Right?
I love Space Ghost.
Well, hey, so this is a project that's kind of TBD as far as release dates, right? It's kind of just quote-unquote soon, right?
You know, I know it's on the schedule, but I'm, you know, living in, you know, production and editorial time, so once my part of the book is done, it drops off my radar. So after we got through the writing and development portion of things, I'm pretty much out of the loop as far as that goes. So I know that the book is on the upcoming schedule, but I, off the top of my head, I couldn't tell you exactly when.
Okay, well, how about we just say when it's done, and probably in 2013.
It's coming.
Okay.
Yeah. You hand in your manuscript, and then you just start blaming the artists whether they're actually at fault or not.
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah. That's a fine tradition that works in comics and games.
Yeah.
Well, hey, if we say spoiler alert, spoiler alert, spoiler alert. Hey, guys, spoiler alert. By the way, spoiler alert. Okay, I'm done now. Can we maybe get some, spoilers for what's happening in the Freedomverse out in space?
Well, the big driving thing that affects the Freedom Universe chapter of the book is the end of the Emerald City Knights adventure arc. And in Emerald City Knights, the characters encounter an ancient artificial intelligence on Earth that is basically deliberately engineering super beings as part of its intended purpose, which is to protect the universe from this greater sort of cosmic threat. And in the last adventure of the series, the heroes get an opportunity to see what this threat is firsthand, and find themselves temporarily transported to the capital world of the Lore Republic, where they meet the Praetor of the Lore Senate and his guards and all of that, just in time basically for this cosmic threat to come along. They get to see just how big and bad it is, because it's basically a giant intelligent singularity essentially that's going around eating star systems, before they get yanked back to Earth, just in time to basically watch the capital of the Lore Republic get crushed and sucked into a singularity and disappear. The heroes back on Earth know that bad things have happened out in space, and the upcoming adventure arc that follows on that, and the material in the campaign setting portion of the book, basically build on that. So the Lore Republic is in chaos. Their capital, their leaders, much of their political and social elite are all gone. Their Republic's enemies are quick to seize on this moment of weakness. So there are several invasions from a couple of different angles. And it throws the whole balance of power out in, this region of Earth's galaxy, out of whack. So instead of a, sort of long Cold War, which has basically existed between the Lore and the Gru Unity, who are the nasty, shape-shifting aliens, instead, basically, there's reignited pockets of conflict all over the place, invasions, conquests, rebellions, whatnot, going on. And of course, Earth is eventually going to become a front somewhere in these conflicts. So there's a lot of new potential conflict going on in the setting.
Well, okay. Hey, this is a horribly geeky question, but that alien intelligence they discover on Earth that's been creating heroes to counteract the cosmic threat. Mm-hmm. It's no relation to Mentor from the Star Knights, right?
Depends on your definition of relation. the Star Knights also play a pretty significant part in what's going on out in the cosmos. And actually, there's a lot of reason why they are pretty well occupied by a number of concerns of their own.
Okay, cool. Well, I don't think I can probably get anything more out of you if I were to, try, so I won't press that anymore. Chris, do you have anything you want to kick in on this subject?
I'm really anxious to see what he wrote now. I haven't seen his part of the book, but it sounds really cool. I'm glad I'm getting a free copy.
Oh, cool. All right, well, let's see. Let me look at the agenda we made up before the podcast. We're going to talk about comic runs, talk about Steve and Chris's enduring love of Legion of Superheroes, Mutants and Mastermind Cosmic Handbook. I think we've covered pretty much everything here. Shoot, and under an hour. That's efficient.
Right?
Yeah. Anything else? Anybody? Any other projects people want to pimp or things we want to talk about before we wrap up?
I'm going to ask Steve something because I'm going to ask him every time I speak to him on this. Do we have any idea when the fourth DC Adventures book is going to be out?
That depends very heavily on DC.
Damn you, DC!
And unfortunately, we're pretty much at the... It will be approved whenever DC says it's approved.
Gotcha.
Then it will be released shortly thereafter. the book's basically done. It's in with DC for approvals. We have gotten some feedback we're making some corrections on a few things. Hopefully, that'll be pretty much it. DC will stamp it, approved shortly thereafter. How quickly that happens when we get it back to them, is anyone's guess. It really depends on, their process.
Okay. All good.
But yeah, it can't be soon enough for me.
That's what I think as well. I'm dying for it. It's going to be marvelous. So, yeah.
You know, and not to be a terrible tease about it, but it is a really cool book.
sad trombone, those. Oh, well. Hey, Steve, is it cool if I ask you if you have any other plans for Icons beyond Great Power, or are we just trying to take it one book at a time?
Well, yeah, I'm trying to, take it one project at a time where that is concerned, and I'd like to get Great Power wrapped up before I dive too deeply into anything else. I do have another adventure from Dane Liebarger, who did Casino of Corruption, that is sitting on my desk in a draft that I need to finish going through. And Dane has another adventure concept warming up in the wings that he's pitched to me that's pretty cool. So those are pretty likely possibilities. I'd like to continue supporting Icons with a lot of adventure content and adversaries, villain write-ups, whether it's in the form of a book like Villainomicon or something, some smaller products with smaller collections of villains. And I've got a number of other ideas, but a lot of it is just a matter of finding the time to, actually work on them. I'd like to keep the support for Icons flowing, but I would like to focus it pretty heavily on utility and on adventures and on stuff that people can play, rather than, expansions of the game as such. I don't think the game needs to expand all that much.
Okay. Well, sorry, Mike. I was just going to ask a question about adventures, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do adventures sell well? Okay, this is a general RPG thing, because I personally think, going back to my old D&D days, I couldn't wait for a new basic adventure, I couldn't wait for a new expert adventure. I've heard so many people in various companies saying, we put adventures out, they never sell. And to me, that is an essential part of the RPG experience, to be able to buy something, read it through, and then you can greet your group and play it. I think this is a fantastic idea. Why is nobody... so many books out there, they put a core book out, and that's all you ever see of it. You don't see anything else. I find that was so annoying.
I think a lot of it is dependent on your definition of well. Yeah, seriously, Icons, which is, primarily most of its support products are adventures, sells okay. I'm happy, with the money that's coming in, and the sales that I'm seeing. I could not, make a full-time living off of it by any stretch of the imagination. But I'm happy with how it's doing. I think that the difficulty with adventures is that although they are absolutely essential as part of the, sort of game's support, they're limited in the sense that they typically only sell to one player out of a group. The game master is usually the only one who's going to buy the adventure. And they have a somewhat limited lifespan in the sense that most adventures, you know, you use them once. You know, some really cherished adventures folks may play through more than once, but generally speaking, you know, you run an adventure and, you know, you might get some additional utility out of a few of the characters in it, but otherwise it's pretty much done. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that fortunately the format that we do for Icons, you know, that puts out, you know, a decent length adventure for, you know, basically, you know, $5, it seems to be a pretty good spot, you know, in the sense that people are willing to pay that, you know, for a game they can run. You know, I think that it runs into difficulty when you have to apply the production values and length and expense to produce a full length printed adventure product, and then the ratio of what you're going to get out of that in terms of a profit margin.
Because obviously we did Improbable Tales, and I think, mm-hmm. I think that was a great idea. I think adventures always needed, and mm-hmm. I think if you can get, you know, 2-3 sessions out of it for the cost, you know, for cheaper than going to see a movie, I mean, what's wrong with that? That's fantastic.
Mm-hmm. I think crowdfunding might be a good way to do adventures for smaller systems, because, you know, Improbable Tales, we only had 40 backers, but we raised $1,000, and you got, was it 11 or 12 adventures?
It's 11 now. It's 11. 11 for one, 11 one will be soon, yeah.
Yeah, they're releasing that soon. That was $12 for 11 adventures if you backed it.
Right.
And goals. So I think you get the people who are into adventures, and we raised enough, we could finance decent art for them. So
yeah,
I probably wouldn't have done that many Improbable Tales. So they had been a Kickstarter.
It would be a very interesting approach to take crowdfunding adventures for, especially for a new game that people are excited about, you know, in the sense of, you know, here's this new game. Now, how badly do you want to play it?
Yeah.
You know, if, you know, how, you know, put your money up and, you know, we'll crank out enough adventures for you to play the game for a year.
That's why there's like the adventure paths that they put through Dragon Magazine, level 1 to 20, I mean, and in like Paizo do now. Mm-hmm. They're fantastic. I mean, who could complain? I mean, we played one of the ones for like 2 years or something ridiculous. How can you? That's marvelous.
Yeah. So, and if I may, there's also another, I think, unique challenge to doing superhero adventures. Okay?
Yes.
If you're doing fantasy. You know, you draw a dungeon, you fill it full of monsters, and you tell people how much XP and treasure they get for killing them. And every fantasy role playing game, universe, campaign in the entire world can play that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, I did Time of Crisis. I got a pen and paper award for it, and all I heard was, "Well, it's too big. There's too much happening." Yeah. So I did Time of Vengeance. I got an Innie for that, and mm-hmm. all I heard was, well, it's set in Freedom City. I don't play in Freedom City.
Freedom City.
We did Emerald City Knights. And, you know, you can make your own judgments as the quality of that. But the only feedback I've seen on our forums is, oh, well, I wanted an adventure, but I didn't want it in Emerald City. Yeah. You know, it's almost like, you know, you ask people, do they want the government to spend less money? And they'll always say yes. But if you start asking them specifics, oh, no, I don't want that cut. I don't want that cut either. You know, adventure seems to be something that people want in general, but they always seem to hate the specifics of it.
Yeah.
So,
it's funny.
Yeah.
I've gotten very similar. Just recently, there was some discussion about someone who one of their criticisms of a lot of the Icons adventures was the fact that not enough of them are set in what could be considered the hero's hometown. That a lot of them involve the characters going somewhere, you know, and they presume a setting that's outside of, you know, our fair city, you know, whatever place the heroes call home. And they were looking for more stuff that was, you know, set sort of in the heroes' backyards. So, like you said, it's hard to please everybody as far as that sort of thing goes, especially with as broad a palette as a superhero setting.
Okay, just to add to that, if there are people that actually do want that, our Stark City set, when it comes out, pretty much all of our Improbable Tales fit within that setting. So if you want to use that,
there
you'll
go.
Find lots of adventures all in the city. We've got plenty of neighbourhoods, loads of stuff.
Yeah, we're going to have three adventures, actually four adventures, because Walt's writing, just turning in a draft today for the fourth adventure.
Exactly.
Yeah, so. We had three from the stretch goals, and we're doing a fourth just because, gosh darn it, we like Stark City so much. So, yeah, it'll, you know, some of that there, too. But Steve Kenson has a new blog.
Yeah, well, I do. I do, yes. I have joined the WordPress crowd, and I updated my ancient website to a new WordPress-based site. So it has allowed me, apart from consuming an inordinate amount of my time, it has allowed me to import a substantial amount of my old website content. I've got 112, 113 articles up there and growing, so I've probably got another 50 or so still to post.
But so, yeah, it's just stevekenson.com, correct?
Yep, stevekenson.com.
So okay. You know you've made it when you've got when your name's just .com at the end of it, that's it.
Well, the wonder of the internet is anybody can, you know, do it. As far
you've
as
got
that goes.
Visitors as well. HSmith.com will probably get zero visitors, so it's hardly worth bothering about, yeah.
Oh, shit. God damn it. You had to bring this up, man. MikeLaffery.com is some psychic.
See, that's why you got to register it.
There you go.
Yeah, I'm not going to. He got his phone number right there. He looks a little. He looks a little. I don't want to call him a hobo, but.
Psychic. This sounds even better.
He can tell you everything except where to find a job. Well, I feel bad now. Don't Google yourself. That's the story there, folks. There's things you don't want to know.
That is a wise, wise piece of advice.
Yeah. AideSmith.com has a password on it.
Okay. Sorry.
We don't know what's there, Aide. So. Okay. Well, hey, that's a little game our listeners can play at home. Type in yourname.com and see what comes up.
Right.
So, all right, folks. Well, hey, I guess we're winding down the hour. Anything else we want to talk about before we call it a podcast?
I think that pretty much covers it.
That sounds like silence is an answer.
General comic thing, just for 2 minutes.
Say what?
I've got a general comics thing.
Okay. What you got?
Should Carrie Kelly be the new Robin?
Carrie Kelly from Dark Knight Returns?
Well, Carrie Kelly, the new 52 version, but yes.
Chris, what do you think?
No one should be the Robin. There are already 7,500 Bat-related characters.
So you're telling me they should be sniping Robins one at a time as they go along?
There are people that have maybe said it better, but I always come back to Tim Burton's response when they ask him why he didn't put Robin in any of his Batman movies. And he said that I could never get past that, yes, we have this dark, obsessed Avenger of the Night fighting the world's most dangerous criminals. And here's a teenage boy in little green tights and booties. We're just going to ignore this. And, you know, I think I just never have liked the fundamental idea of Robin to begin with. And the fact that now that everybody, I don't know, I haven't checked. Is Ace the Bat-Hound back yet?
No, unfortunately not.
Because there's a Batwoman and a Batgirl and Nightwing and whatever the heck Tim Drake is this week, and now there's African Batman and Canadian Batman and Australian Batman and can we let one of them go?
I love the characters from Batman Inc. The Knight and Squire. I mean, they're British, for Christ's sake, you know.
Well, I can't argue with that.
You have a full run of Captain Marvel, don't you, Aide?
Maybe.
Okay.
I'll certainly take him over Batman of Alabama, certainly, you know. With the Bat truck.
Wouldn't that just be the Dukes of Hazzard?
It would probably frighteningly close.
The Dukes of Hazzard are the Green Arrows of the South.
Oh, God.
Yeah, actually, you're spot on, aren't you? They even have trick arrows,
right?
They did have trick arrows. That's very true. Yes.
This is an Elseworlds mashup I want to see.
Yes.
That's the Dukes of Gotham.
This is writing itself. This is great. We can just get Evel Knievel in there as Nightwing. It'll be a perfect 70s, 80s kind of...
Yep. Yep. All right, guys. Make an excellent Boss Hog.
Holy shit, this is writing itself, guys.
Do you remember the Goofy I was talking about earlier?
Yeah, here we are. So who's the Joker in that?
Gosh.
That's tough.
Cletus?
Well,
Cletus, you know, as we all suspected, turns out to be a secret psychotic mastermind, then sure.
That works.
Roscoe did have the laugh, though. You gotta give it, yeah, he did have the giggle.
You know, before we go any further down this particular rabbit hole, I'm gonna have to end this podcast because it's not gonna get any better. So, Chris, Steve, Walt, Aid, thanks for your time, guys.
Pleasure as always.
Appreciate it, gentlemen.
And until next time, we will... I have to get a better sign-off. We'll see you next time on the Banff Podcast. Thanks, folks.
Night.
Bye.
Good night.
Bye.